is, well, I should say, what I've done is the following. I've shown you that we proved an important theorem. We said that the coefficient A sub n in a Fourier series is defined as 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to pi dx sine of nx f of x. Okay? So if you want to represent a function using a Fourier series, you want to represent the function f of x, what we did was we said, let's define the nth Fourier coefficient is that. Okay? And what we then showed was that if f of x, f of x equals 0 at x equals 0 or pi, and pi, both 0 and pi, what we showed was that then a sub n goes to 0 faster than 1 over n squared. And we did that by just using integration by parts. Okay, just a very simple argument. Integration by parts on this, and we use the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay, so combining integration by parts and the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay. But if this is not true, then typically the Fourier series coefficients, the Fourier coefficients behave like 1 over n, and the Fourier series is only conditionally convergent. And the question is, does the Fourier series converge? That is, so the question is the sum of a sub n sine of nx, can that actually be equal to, question, you know, is this equal to f of x? That's the question. And I want to show you that even though the Fourier series is only conditionally convergent, not absolutely convergent, indeed, this sum is equal to f of x. And I want to show it to you for a simple case, obviously nice, simple case. A nice exercise, by the way, very nice exercise, would be to show it in general, and I'll indicate how you would prove such a thing. But let's take a nice simple case and go through the proof so you see how it works. And it's not actually a very long proof. It's actually a very short and clever proof. So let's consider the function. So example, let's consider the function f of x is equal to 1. And numerically, I showed you that the Fourier series does converge to the number 1. Okay, numerically. I mean, it was pretty obvious that it was converging. But let's see if we can actually prove this. Okay? Well, for the function f of x equals 1, the Fourier coefficients are, if I remember correctly, they were 4 over pi n if n is odd and 0 if n is even. Okay. Do you want to go through that argument? We can. Is that good? Pretty simple? I think that's pretty simple. Okay. Okay. How do you prove it? Just how do you do this calculation? You just plug in f of x equals 1 here, and you have this thing to evaluate. Okay. And if you evaluate the integral of sine of nx, you get cosine of nx over n. Okay, and when you evaluate cosine between 0 and pi, at pi you get a minus 1 to the n. At 0, you get 1. Okay. Okay, and minus 1 to the n is either plus or minus 1. So it either cancels that 1 or it adds to the 1, making 2. So there's a 4 over n pi. Okay, but for the even case, the minus 1 to the n cancels the 1, and that gives you 0. Okay, so that's the, those are the Fourier coefficients. So the Fourier series for f of x equals just 1, that Fourier series is the sum from, let's not call it n, let's call it something else, j. J goes from 0 to infinity. And the Fourier series is now 4 over pi, 4 over pi, that's the constant, times sine of 2j plus 1, just the odd numbered n's, times x, okay, over 2j plus 1. So that's sine of nx over n for odd n. Okay? And the question is, do you believe, is there even a faint chance that this thing could be equal to 1? It's hard to believe, because if this is a true statement, okay, this is the question. If this is a true statement, you have to be really impressed, because the left-hand side depends on x. It's x dependent. So somehow, if this were true, the x dependence has to somehow go away, miraculously. And it's got to be equal to a constant, 1. Which is hard to imagine that this is actually going to be true. Okay, so. Sorry?
And x equals 0.
And of course, x equals 0, we have to discuss that case. Okay, so the question is, how is this going to work? What we saw numerically, remember, what we saw numerically was this. This is the x-axis. Here's 0. Here's pi, right? Here is the function 1 that we're trying to calculate. And what we saw was numerically, the Fourier series did the following. It started at 0. It came up. It overshot by 18%. So this is the number 1.18. Okay? And then it very rapidly, you know, approached 1, and it was oscillating very, very, very closely about 1. And then, once again, the oscillations, these wiggles got bigger and bigger. It overshot by 18% and then came down to 0. And as you take more and more terms in the series, what I claim happens is that this oscillation in the middle dies down. And what you end up with is a very strange function. You end up with a function that is 1 everywhere. Right at the very end, it overshoots by 18% and then instantly comes back down to 0. Okay? And this oscillation at the endpoints, this has a name. This is called the Gibbs phenomenon. And most people regard this Gibbs phenomenon is associated with the non-uniform convergence, the conditional convergence of Fourier series. Okay? And most people think this is a pathological property of Fourier series. That's very bad. Okay? And I'm going to show you that, in fact, it's very good. It's really wonderful. And it's the thing, the slow convergence of Fourier series is what allows us to use them to solve very difficult and very non-trivial problems. Okay, so let's see if we can study the convergence of that series. Okay? So to study it, let's construct the partial sums So we're going to study the convergence of the partial sums. So let's call the nth partial sum, which is a function of x, let's call that the sum from j equals 0 to capital N. So the sum of the first n, or n plus 1, actually, terms in that series. So it's sine of 2j plus 1 x over 2j plus 1, and we'll throw in that factor of 4 over pi. And the question is, does s sub n of x approach 1 as n goes to infinity? you believe that that actually happens. Okay, so the question is, can you sum this series? And, you know, as a finite sum, can you do that? And I can't do that. I mean, it's really hard to, you know. So is there some trick that we can use to sum this series? And the only thing I can think of doing here, well, what am I going to do? What's the natural thing? You know, the hard part here is this stupid 2j plus 1 in the denominator. That's really hard. So what should we do? Sure. Let's try taking a derivative here. So. Sorry. Let's calculate. Let's calculate Sn prime of x. That seems like a natural thing to do, because now we get 4 over pi sum from j equals 0 to n cosine of 2j plus 1 x. So that stupid denominator has gone away. This is kind of tricky, though. This is more than just a little bit tricky. What are we going to do now? Well, let's write out the cosine. Okay, you know that cosine of x is e to the ix plus e to the minus ix over 2. Okay, so let's substitute that in here. So there's a 2 in the denominator, which makes the 4 into a 2. Okay, and now we have this sum of e to the ix and e to the minus x from 0 to n. And let's just write out what those terms are. For the case n, we have e to the 2n plus 1 ix. Let's start with the negative term first, okay? Then, so this is the case, when I plug in j equals n, I'm writing down this term. The next term would be e to the minus 2n minus 1 ix, right? And then so on, e to the minus 2n minus 3. So these numbers are gradually getting smaller and smaller until we get all the way down to the case j equals 0, which would be e to the minus ix. Right, so this is the term j equals 0 in the sum. So I started at n, went all the way down to 0, right? And then it starts, then the powers have positive imaginary terms, right? The next term would be e to the ix, e to the 3 ix, and so on, all the way up to e to the 2n plus 1 ix. Okay, that's just writing out all those exponentials. That's what I get. Okay, let's see. Maybe just for fun, let's factor out this e to the minus. So I could write this as 2 over pi e to the minus 2n plus 1 ix. Because if I do that, then the first term in the series is 1, and the next term is e to the 2ix, and the next term is e to the 4ix, da 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 da. And it goes all the way up to e to the 4n plus 2 ix. Okay? So have we accomplished anything? I mean, do I know how to sum this series at least? The answer is yes. What is that series? This is a geometric series. And you know, in general, you know that 1 plus r squared plus r to the n is equal to the common ratio is r. So it would be 1 over 1 minus r time in the denominator. In the numerator, would be 1 minus r to the n plus 1. That's the sum of a finite geometric series. By the way, it's a good thing we're doing this for the partial sum of the series, right? Because if we try to attack just the entire infinite series, this would be a disaster, right? Do you see why? That's right. It doesn't converge. Why is that? Because this series only converges. If you let n go to infinity, you can let n go to infinity only if the absolute value of r is less than 1. Okay? And here, the absolute value of r, what's r in this case? R in this case is e to the 2ix. Right? That's r. Okay, and in absolute value, the absolute value of r here in this case is exactly 1. So we can only talk about the partial sum of the series. This doesn't look very hopeful, right? Because it looks like we're going to have a lot of trouble letting n go to infinity. But let's proceed anyway. So this gives us 2 over pi e to the minus 2n plus 1 ix. And just plugging in the formula for geometric series, this gives me in the denominator 1 minus e to the 2ix. That's r. Okay? And then in the numerator, we have 1 minus. And n in this case, you know, e to r to the n, this is here n. So I have to replace n by n plus 1. So n, the thing that I wrote down, n over there, n in this case for that formula would be 2n plus 2. Right? Is that OK? So this thing gives me e to the 2ix, that's the r, times 2n plus 2. 2n plus 2. OK? Yeah. 2n, n here is 2n plus 1, so I have to write 2n plus 2,
okay.
Right? Because this is r to the n plus 1, right? Is it okay? I don't want to make a mistake here, or else it'll be very embarrassing, and I'll start to cry. Okay. So, all right. So this thing is e to the ix times 4n plus 4, okay? Multiply that out. Well, the only thing I can think of doing now is to multiply this guy back, which we factored out. So this thing becomes now 2 over pi 1 minus e to the 2ix. And this thing here is e to the minus 2n plus 1ix. If I multiply it in here, I have minus, so I have to subtract 2n plus 1. So I get e to the ix times 2n plus 3, if I did it right. OK? And I can make this just a wee bit better, just a tiny bit better, if I factor out from the numerator and the denominator, if I factor out a power of e to the ix. It'll make this a little bit more symmetric. So I could write this as e to the minus ix minus e to the ix. And then in the numerator, I would have an e to the minus 2n plus 2ix and then minus e to the 2n plus 2ix. OK, that looks a lot more symmetric. And we're almost there now. Because now, having summed the geometric series, I can divide the top and the bottom by a factor of 2i. So remember, this is the formula here for cosine. Remember the formula for sine. Remember, sine of x is equal to e to the ix minus e to the minus ix over 2i. Okay, so I could divide the top and the bottom here by a factor of 2i. Also, I could multiply the top and the bottom by a minus sign, just to fix things up. And this would give me 2 over pi times sine of 2n plus 2x
over sine of x.
Okay, that looks interesting, but it seems that we haven't solved the problem we wanted to solve, because we wanted to calculate s sub n of x, and all I've calculated is sn prime of x. So I ought to integrate. Okay? So here we go. Here is sn of x. It is the integral, let's call it ds or something like that, 2 over pi times sine of 2n plus 2 s over sine of s. Okay? That's sine of x, where I'm integrating up to x. But I have to, I have an integration constant, right? When I do an integral, there's a constant of integration. And the natural place to integrate from is 0, right? Because if I put in a 0 here, the left-hand side vanishes at x equals 0, obviously, right? It's a bunch of signs evaluated at 0. So the left-hand side is 0, and the right-hand side is 0 when x equals 0. So I'm there. So I haven't solved the problem yet. I merely have summed this very difficult series. Okay, so I had a series here that I didn't know how to evaluate, and I've now expressed a finite sum of terms now as an integral, and I want to study what happens as n goes to infinity in this integral. Okay? I think there's just enough room to finish over here. Okay, so the question is, what is the limit as n goes to infinity of this formula here? And the problem here is that I don't know how to do this. I couldn't do this series here. You know, there's a principle of conservation of effort. Okay? If it's difficult to sum this series as a finite series, it's difficult to evaluate that integral. And of course I can't do the integral. I don't know how to integrate sine of a constant times s divided by sine of s. I don't know how to do that. So we need another trick. Okay? So here's what I suggest. Do you know what I'm going to do? We need a trick here. In the denominator, there's a sine of s. So here's what I suggest. How about subtracting 1 over s and adding back 1 over s? I haven't done anything. Of course, I've added and subtracted the same thing. But what was the problem with evaluating that integral? The problem with doing the integral is that there's a sine in the denominator. So I'm going to subtract off 1 over s and add back 1 over s. And now I have two integrals to do. The first integral, so I've written now s sub n of x. The first integral is 2 over pi times integral from 0 to x ds sine of 2n plus 1, 2n plus 2. S times 1 over sine of s minus 1 over s. The second integral is 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to x ds sine of 2n sine of 2n plus 2s just divided by s. Okay? Now, let's look at this. What happens as n goes to infinity? What happens to this integral here as n goes to infinity?
It's singular at 0.
It is? No, it isn't. That's why I subtracted 1 over s. You see, near zero sine of s is approximately s. And I've subtracted the 1 over s so that this function here is smooth and analytic at zero. If you don't believe me, work out the Taylor series. Okay? This thing is smooth at zero and it has a Taylor expansion. Okay? And so this has the form of alpha n s to the n near zero for s near zero. Sum from n equals 0 to infinity, and there is no singularity term. There's no pole at s equals 0. That's why I subtracted it off. Okay? So this is a smooth function. And n is going to infinity. Therefore, it's 0. Why? What? The Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Exactly. This thing goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. That's good. So I've replaced an integral I can't do in the limit as n goes to infinity by an integral that I can do. And let's do that integral. Yeah?
Can you just remind us what the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says?
Yeah, the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says that, in general, if you integrate, say, from 0 to any constant here, it doesn't have to be pi or some constant c, okay, which in this case is x. If you integrate sine of nx times some function of x, if this function of x is smooth and integrable and absolutely integrable, which this is, okay, then this goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. It's an oscillation theorem. It says that it oscillates to 0 so long as f of x is smooth, and by construction, f of x is smooth. It's quite beautiful. Okay? So this is the only thing that we have to think about. But this is a much simpler integral. So to evaluate this integral, what am I going to do? Well, there's a natural substitution. Let's make a new integration variable, which is this 2n plus 2 times s. We can call that t, for example, just t. And then we can divide by 2n plus 2 here. So now this becomes t, and we can multiply by 2n plus 2. So the multiple, you know, ds times 2n plus 2, this just becomes dt. So with that simple change of variables, this guy becomes 2 over pi integral from 0 to, and now with that change of variables, x is replaced by x times 2n plus 2, okay, dt sine of t over t. Okay. Now, you've had some complex variables, right? That's what I was told. And that means you may know how to evaluate the following integral. I mean, suppose x is fixed. Suppose x is fixed and x is not equal to 0. So x is some positive number, x, let's say fixed x between 0 and pi. X is not 0, x is not pi. It's a fixed number. So if I let n go off to infinity, all that happens is that the endpoint of integration is going off to infinity, and this integral approaches 2 over pi, integral from 0 to infinity, dt sine of t over t. What is this integral equal to? Well, if you've had complex variables, you know it equals pi over 2. If you haven't had complex variables, do you know how to evaluate that integral? That's actually non-trivial. This is a non-trivial integral. But you can do this integral just using freshman calculus. Just using, if you don't know complex variables, that's fine. You can do that integral perfectly easily using, well, not easily, but you have to be a little bit clever. How do you evaluate that integral? Yeah, what would you do?
So we know the Laplace transform of sine of t is 1 over s squared plus t squared.
Very good. Very good. So basically, we don't have to use the Laplace transform as a fancy word, but you're absolutely right. That's how you can attack the problem. If you've never heard of the word Laplace transform, I'm still going to use the exponential transformation to evaluate it. So how do I do that? So let's just talk for a second about how in the world you would evaluate this integral, okay? If you didn't know complex variables. Okay. So let's just, so this is, this here is for x fixed and between 0 and pi. Okay, if x were 0, then, or near 0, we can't say what we just said. But here, x is not 0 and not pi. It's a fixed number. And we let n go to infinity, keeping x fixed. Okay, so n goes to infinity, x fixed. Okay, so how do you evaluate that integral? Here's a trick for you. And I won't go through the calculation. But how do we evaluate sine of t over t dt? What's the problem with doing the integral? There's a stupid t in the denominator. How do we fix it? We'll call this integral I. We'll introduce a small perturbation parameter. OK? You said the key word, Laplace transform. But I'm going to introduce, this is a hard problem. How do I do the integral? I can make it into an easy problem by, instead of considering one hard problem, I'll consider an infinite number of hard problems. OK? So I'll consider instead the integral from 0 to infinity sine of t over t e to the minus a t. We can call it epsilon. Epsilon t dt. OK? Now, of course, the thing that we're trying to evaluate is I of 0. That's I of 0. That's a hard integral to do. So I'm going to consider an infinite number of integrals. Okay. Now, I prime of epsilon is the integral from 0 to infinity. When you take a derivative with respect to epsilon, you pull down a t. And that gives you minus sine of t e to the minus epsilon t. Got it? Now I can do this integral. It's easy. Can you tell me for a moment, how do I do this integral? This is a true freshman calculus test problem. How do you do that integral? By parts. That's right. Everybody should know that. You evaluate this integral by parts. You integrate by parts once. The sine turns into a cosine. And we get a factor of epsilon. You integrate by parts twice. The cosine turns back into a sine. And you get an epsilon squared. So you conclude that I prime of epsilon is minus, or plus, something like that, 1 over 1 plus epsilon squared, something like that. Okay, it may be minus or plus, I don't know, minus, whatever, plus a constant. OK? And now we have to integrate this. This is I prime of epsilon. If you integrate this to calculate epsilon, this turns out to be just pi over 2 plus or minus, yeah, that's right, minus arc tangent of, or in fact, yeah, sorry. This is what I prime of epsilon is. If you integrate it, you would get minus arc tangent of epsilon. There you go, arc tangent of epsilon plus pi over 2. And pi over 2 is the integration constant. Okay, how did I know this is the correct integration constant? Because there's one value of epsilon for which I can evaluate this integral. And that is epsilon equals infinity. Okay, and I know that at epsilon equals infinity, this vanishes. And indeed, at epsilon equals infinity, this vanishes. Arc tangent of infinity is pi over 2. So this vanishes. And now all I do is I set epsilon equal to 0. And I see that I of 0 is pi over 2. And that's how you evaluate that integral. Got it? So now we go back over here. This integral is pi over 2. So for fixed x between 0 and pi, the limit is 1. by golly, the Fourier series converged to 1 for all x not equal to 0 or pi. That's the proof. You've seen it right in front of your eyes. And if we wanted to do it in general, there's only a little bit more. That would be a good, very good practice problem. All you need to do is to remember that the nth, you're studying the convergence of the Fourier series. So all you have to remember is that you would replace this by the formula for the nth Fourier coefficient, which is the integral from 0 to pi, 2 over pi, sine of nx times f of x. And you'd interchange orders of integration and summation, which you can do if there are only a finite number of terms in the sum. Okay? So bingo, you're done. Okay? So it's basically the same proof. But the interesting part is what is happening at x is equal to 0 and x is equal to pi. So instead of plugging in x equals 0, we're going to study what happens near 0. OK, so let's see. We can erase this. So again, I proved that the Fourier series, which is very slowly converging, it's conditionally convergent, converges to 1 if x is a fixed number between 0 and pi. But now the question is, what happens as n goes to infinity and x is very near 0? Can we see that 18% stuff? How do we study it? Well, what we say is, let's let n go to infinity and x go to 0 at the same time, such that the product of x times 2n plus 2 remains fixed. So do you see what I'm doing? I'm taking more and more terms in the Fourier series, and at the same time, I'm getting closer and closer to 0. This is called a correlated limit. And particle physicists study correlated limits all the time. This is the simplest version of the double scaling limit. Okay? This is precisely a double scaling limit. And you know that in the case of the I don't know if you've have you talked about this?
No.
It's probably too fancy. But in the double scaling limit, what you find is that the quantum field theory approaches a universal quantum field theory in that limit. That limit is a universal global limit, pretty much independent of the theory you started with. It's a special global universal limit, depending on...
In the CFT course, they might talk about that.
Maybe so. Anyway, this is a very fancy limit, but here it's not so fancy, and this is the simplest version of a correlated limit, a double scaling limit. So let's see what happens. Well, let's give this a number. Let's call this something y. Okay, some fixed number y. Okay? Then in that case, the integral in that case is this. We just go back here. That is the sum of the series, the limit as n goes to infinity of the Fourier series is 2 over pi integral from 0 to y dt sine of t over t. All right. Can anybody tell me how to do that integral? Before, y was infinity. And this came out to be 1. But what if y is not infinity? It's just some number. How do we do that integral? Well, you can't do the integral. All you can do is what biologists used to do. You give it a name. You know, if you go to a zoo, nobody understands what a lion is. So you're looking at this animal. You don't know what it is. So you call it lion. Okay, now you think you know something that you didn't know before, but of course you didn't. You just knew the name of the thing. So this is exactly what mathematicians do. You can't do the integral.
So instead, we're going to call this function si of y.
Si stands for sine integral. Okay, and if you look it up in a book, this is called si of y. Big deal. Okay, so this is the function 2 over pi times si of y. And I said there's a universal limit, and this is the universal limit. In fact, independent of whatever function you're calculating, originally we said let f of x be 1. But you could have taken f of x to be any function you like, and you would still get si of y. It's universal. It's true for any function here, any function at all. Okay, so now we have to ask, how does si of y behave? Well, it's easy. The first thing you know is that si of 0, we can make a plot of this function. Si of 0 is obviously 0, because you're integrating from 0 to 0. Okay, and I'm just doing freshman calculus here. When you make a graph, you know, what does, here is the y-axis, and here's si of y. We know that this function starts at 0. And what do you do next to make a plot? Well, you want to find out where its maxima are and its minima and so on. So we have to differentiate this. Ah, now I'm good at it. OK. So look, si prime of y is just sine of y over y. And where is this derivative 0? It's 0 wherever sine of y is 0, which is equal to pi, 2 pi, 3 pi, and so on, right? So therefore, at pi and 2 pi and 3 pi and 4 pi and so on, this function has a maximum and a minimum. So since it's 0 over here, and it is a this is a function that I can plot, okay? There is some sort of maximum over here at pi. Function comes up. There's a minimum. There's maximum, minimum, maximum. It oscillates. I don't care about that. But I want you to notice something. And it doesn't look like that's a bad plot. What it looks like is this. Comes up, comes down here to a minimum. Comes up, comes down, comes up. Okay, that's what it looks like. And at pi, you see this is where the biggest maximum is. So what is the value of the, I know there's a maximum over here. What is the value of the function over here? To find this function, we plug in y is equal to pi, and this thing is equal to 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to pi, sine of t over t dt. And if you evaluate that number, what do you think you get? You get 1.18. It's actually 1.179, blah, blah, blah. You can do it numerically on your computer. So this rises to a maximum of 1.18. That's the famous 18% overlap. Okay? So what have I shown? This is what I've shown. Here is x. Here is the limit as n goes to infinity of s sub n of x, the limit of the partial sums. I showed you that if x lies between 0 and pi, as some fixed number in this range between 0 and pi, the limiting value is exactly 1. This is 1. Okay? And then I investigated this tiny, tiny region whose thickness goes to 0 as n goes to infinity, right? Y is a fixed number, so x, in that case, is y divided by 2n plus 2. So this is a very, very tiny region for fixed y as n goes to infinity, and that is the tiny region we were just investigating. And in this tiny region, the function goes up to a maximum of 1.18, and then it comes down and oscillates, and it approaches 1. So this is approaching 1. and the limit is y goes to infinity. And then we have this oscillation, da da da, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then eventually at pi, it goes down to zero. And exactly the same thing happens on the other side. Okay? Yeah?
Are we allowed to say that y is constant? Because n is consists of integers and y and x is a real number.
Yeah, but we can take, we have here, this is now, the fact that we started out taking n to be integers, that's fine. Okay, but n is, we no longer care that n is an integer. N is just a big number, a very big number. If you insist on taking n to be integers, that's fine. Doesn't matter to me. Okay? But this is a formula which is a function of n. Okay? We are talking about the integral from 0 to x times 2n plus 2. And this is a number that I'm calling y. If you insist on thinking of n only as an integer, you have every right to do so. In fact, in the United States, probably the Constitution gives you the right to. You have the freedom to. I don't know if in Canada that's. But we're sufficiently close to the border that you could jump into a car or a taxi or something and drive across the border and then insist that n is an integer. But it doesn't matter. N is just some big number, okay? It doesn't make any difference. Okay, so this is the Gibbs phenomenon. And the Gibbs phenomenon is a universal behavior. It has nothing to do with the fact that a long time ago, at the beginning of this lecture, we were saying that f of x is 1. Has nothing to do with that at all. Nothing at all. Okay? Now, okay, you were going to make a comment.
So we're taking y to infinity.
No. Y is a fixed number that interpolates between x equals 0 and x is a very small number.
I see.
Okay? X is a very, 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 very small number. Y is a fixed number. And as y goes to infinity, so here is, this is the point y equals 0. And this is the point y equals infinity, where we have approached 1. And this is a tiny, tiny region that I have blown up. I have expanded by a factor of 2n plus 2, just blown up that region. Okay, so this is a teeny-weeny region. And in that tiny region, those are the Gibbs oscillations that reflect the fact that we have a non-uniformly convergent series.
So y is a new coordinate in some sense.
Y is a new coordinate. It's what you could call a stretched coordinate. Okay. I have blown up the x coordinate and magnified, using a microscope, this tiny region between 0 and a fixed but infinitesimal value of x. Okay? Yeah.
I wanted to ask, why is it universal? Is it because you can form massive
planetary series? It's not obviously universal. So at this point, we only know that this function si has appeared because we are studying, we are asking, can you expand f of x equals 1 in a Fourier series? But now, if you said, let's just take any old function, not 1, let's take some function, but an interesting function, a function which, say, starts at some number here, you know, alpha, and then wanders off like this. Okay? And in the region staying away from 0 and going up to, you know, pi minus epsilon and starting at epsilon here, in this region, the Fourier series converges so long as this function f of x is continuous. That's all we need, that f of x is continuous. In that region, the Fourier series, the partial sums of the Fourier series, converge to this function. But in the teeny-weeny little region between 0 and epsilon, if we expand it up, you will see that the function overshoots by 18% and the oscillations gradually die out as it approaches alpha. Okay, so the peak of this oscillation would be 1.18 times alpha. Okay, it's universal in that sense, but you don't know that yet. You could show this just by summing the Fourier series, the partial sums of the Fourier series, for some arbitrary function, an exactly the same function, si, appears. So si is the universal function that describes the Gibbs phenomenon. This is the part that is never discussed in courses on Fourier series. This is the guts of the Fourier series. You've now seen it. And the guts lies in the double scaling limit. That's where the guts is. Okay. And this is the genius of Fourier series. And I'm going to show you. Now, generally, the Gibbs phenomenon is mentioned in courses on Fourier series. It's generally mentioned. And most teachers, including my teachers, said to me, of course, this is a pathological property of Fourier series. We're sorry about this. They're ugly because they engage in this oscillation. Wrong. This is the reason why Fourier series are wonderful. They missed the point completely. Okay. But now, before we get to that, I want to make sure that you understand what I'm saying. If we have a function which is continuous in the interval from 0 to pi, like the function 1, the Fourier series converges pointwise, that's what we showed, to the function f of x. The first time this was proved was very recently. A fully rigorous proof wasn't actually established until very recently, the late 1900s, 1970 or 1980, something like that. Okay. So it's only then that Fourier series first began to be understood. But the problem is with the problem with Fourier series is that the nth coefficient in our Fourier series, if the function doesn't vanish at x equals 0 and vanish at x equals 0, at x equals pi, these terms in the Fourier series go to 0 like 1 over n. So if you ever tried to add this up on a computer, you'd go nuts. Okay? So let me try to explain to you what we're going to do. Okay. So you're walking down the street, and a guy comes up to you, okay, says, I have the following Fourier series. Okay? Guy comes up to you and says, I have this Fourier series, and I would like to know the function f of x that this Fourier series represents. Okay? And he gives you the bad news. The bad news is, let's say, a sub n is equal to e to the 1 over n minus 1. Okay, that's a nice, crazy Fourier series. Okay? So you look at this Fourier series and you say, uh-oh, because as n goes to infinity, this is, what is e to the 1 over n for large n? Are you shy or you just, I hope you are. Okay. That's for large n. That's what a sub n looks like. Okay. The ones cancel. And this Fourier series behaves like 1 over n. 1 over n plus 1 over 2n squared plus. Okay? That's what this Fourier series behaves like. Okay. So that means we have a non-uniformly convergent Fourier series. This Fourier series is conditionally convergent. It is not absolutely convergent. It is not uniformly convergent. This Fourier series, because there's a 1 over n term in it, has a Gibbs phenomenon. And the guy says to you, look, I really need to know this function f of x. So I've had it on my computer, and it's been running all night long. And it's still oscillating up and down and bouncing around. And I have no idea what this function f of x is. Can you help me? You say, oh, no problem. I've been taking a course at the perimeter. Okay? So I know how to accelerate the convergence of this Fourier series. Okay? This is a slowly converging, it's a converging series, but this is a series whose convergence I can accelerate. How do I accelerate the convergence? Well, I say, let me write this Fourier series as a sum of two Fourier series. The first Fourier series will be 1 over n times sine of nx. Because that's the thing that causes slow convergence. Okay? Of course, the remaining Fourier series would be e to the 1 over n minus 1 minus 1 over n times sine of nx. Okay? So I haven't done anything. I've just written it as, I've added and subtracted the term 1 over n. Then you go to a textbook and you say, is there a Fourier series whose coefficients are 1 over, just simply 1 over n? And of course, there are lots of tables, but this is a particularly simple one. This is easy to remember. I happen to know that the Fourier series 1 over n times sine of nx, sum from 1 to infinity, happens to be pi minus x over 2. Okay? If you don't believe it, in 2 minutes, you can evaluate this integral over here. Just plug in for f of x, pi minus x over 2. Evaluate this integral using integration by parts. And in a second, you'll see that the coefficients of that Fourier series are 1 over n. So notice that the first Fourier series sums up to pi minus x over 2. The remaining Fourier series has the form sum from n equals 1 to infinity, b sub n sine of nx, where b sub n for large n, how does that go for large n? 1 over n squared. Now, 1 over n squared, that's a much more rapidly convergent series. In fact, this Fourier series is uniformly and absolutely convergent. Therefore, this Fourier series has no Gibbs phenomenon. The function, whatever the crazy function is that this Fourier series represents, what is the value of that function at x equals 0? There's no Gibbs phenomenon. So therefore, at 0, this function is 0. At pi, this function is 0. There's no Gibbs phenomenon here, because the Fourier coefficients for large n go like 1 over n squared. So if you needed to know f of 0, this function at x equals 0 is equal to pi over 2, unambiguously. Do you see what we did? The guy gave us a Fourier series that was not uniformly convergent. It was a very slowly converging series. Now, we've represented it as pi minus x over 2 times that plus that Fourier series. And this Fourier series is very rapidly convergent. Of course, it's not extremely rapidly convergent, but it's very rapidly convergent. What would you suggest? Suppose the guy is, his pocket calculator is kind of slow.
Okay.
Absolutely. So you've nailed it. So now, what would you do? Let's take out, instead of just that, we'll take out a 1 over n squared, well, a 1 over 2n squared as well, right? And then we'll put it back in, and that gives us the Fourier series 1 over n squared times sine of nx. And I don't know what that function is, but you can look it up in a book. So we can sum that Fourier series exactly. And now we have a Fourier series which is even better convergent. It converges, the terms in this series converge like 1 over 6n cubed. Of course, maybe he's not happy, so you take out the next term and the next term. And we have just accelerated the convergence of a Fourier series. Okay, so this converges wonderfully. Okay? Okay? So now, let's solve a hard problem. Yeah, this is going to work. The timing is going to work very well. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so now you know. But first, there was, I saw somebody was going to ask a question. Who was? Somebody just raised his hand. Was it you? Did you just? Yeah, you're okay. Okay, so let's make, you now know everything you need to know about Fourier series. You understand the acceleration of convergence? This is fantastic. We have absorbed the Gibbs phenomenon, and we understand that this Fourier series has the ability to represent a function even at zero with a well-defined value. The Fourier series knows, even though the, do you see what we've done? The Fourier series adds up to 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, but by accelerating the convergence of the series, we know that in this case, 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 for this function is pi over 2. That's an example of what we can do when we accelerate the convergence. So let me give you now a very hard problem. Yeah, this is going to be great. Okay. Okay, so let's now try to attack a really hard problem. We're going to go back to the problem that I posed last Friday. So let's solve the equation ut equals uxx, the heat equation, okay? And we're going to solve it for x between 0 and pi and t greater than 0. Okay, t greater than 0. Our initial condition is that u of x and 0 is some function f of x, and that u of 0 and t is g of t, some heat bath here, and u of pi and t is h of t. So you understand, we're solving the heat equation. This is the x-axis, here's the t-axis, here is pi, and we're solving it in that region. And we're giving an initial condition here called f of x, and boundary conditions here and here called g of t and h of t. Okay? Now, so this is how I argue. We all agree now that Fourier series can be used to represent a continuous function between 0 and pi. Okay? We can represent a continuous function between 0 and pi. No problem. Okay? So I'm going to use a Fourier series to do that. So I'm going to say u of x and t is equal to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity a sub n of t, well, a, let's write it this way, a sub n times sine of nx. So I have represented this function, but of course we know that a sub n must be a function of t. Got it? So here we go. We know that the solution to the heat equation is continuous and smooth. Therefore, it has a Fourier series. Of course, this Fourier series is this g of t is in general not equal to 0, and h of t is in general not equal to 0, but we're no longer afraid of that. Okay? So here is the way to represent the solution. Okay? Good. Well, we're solving that differential equation, so all I need to do is to plug this solution into the differential equation. Fourier series are unique. So I can set the coefficients of the Fourier series equal on the left and on the right, and I'm done. Okay? You all with me? So let's do it. So the time derivative of this gives me the sum from n equals 1 to infinity a sub n prime of t sine of n x. Okay? And now I have to take two space derivatives of this, and that gives me the sum from n equals 1 to infinity, a sub n of t, and two derivatives of sine of nx is minus n squared times sine of nx. Okay? Now, okay. Now, Fourier series are unique, and therefore I know that the coefficient of sine of nx on both sides of that equation has to be the same. And so I conclude that a sub n prime of t is equal to minus n squared a of t. Okay? Now, this is a differential equation, and I need to have an initial condition to solve that equation uniquely. But I know the initial condition because I know what a sub n of 0 is. Can you tell me what a sub n of 0 is? Fourier transform of f of x. That's right. So it is explicitly 2 over pi integral from 0 to pi dx f of x, my initial condition, right, times sine of nx. Okay? So this is, you do this integral. I don't know what f of x is, but you do the integral. You get a bunch of numbers. That is a sub n of 0 times 0, the initial condition. Okay. I have an initial condition. I have a differential equation. So I'm going to solve the differential equation. The differential equation is trivial, right? A sub n of t is some constant times e to the minus n squared t. And we know what this constant is. At t equals 0, this constant must be a sub n of 0, e to the minus n squared t. So I plug this back into the initial Fourier series, and I get u of x and t is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity sine of nx times e to the minus n squared t times a sub n of 0. There you go. There's the answer, right? Good point. I have screwed up miserably. This solution doesn't know anything about G or H. It never entered. What's going on? Do you all see that? This is what happened. Look. Let's say this again. This is really simple, right? I said, let's represent the answer as a Fourier series. We plug it into the differential equation. We get this. We match coefficients term by term. You solve, you get this. You solve this differential equation subject to the initial condition. Bang, there's the answer. What could be simpler? In fact, this Fourier series is a wonderful Fourier series. Why is that? It converges very rapidly. In fact, look at that. When t is greater than 0, this Fourier series converges like a shot. It converges faster than any power of 1 over n. So we don't have to accelerate the convergence of that Fourier series. If t is equal to 1 already, you need essentially no terms in this series to sum it up. Because by the time you get to t equals 2, you have n squared here, which is e to the minus 4t. I mean, right? So just two or three terms in the Fourier series give me a very accurate answer. The only problem is, it's the wrong answer. In fact, What problem have we solved here? If this Fourier series converges faster than any power of 1 over n, then it turns out that u of 0 nt must be 0, and u of pi nt must be 0. And in fact, once we know that u of 0 nt and u of pi nt, suppose we know that u of 0 nt is 0, then from the heat equation itself, if we just take the derivative with respect to t, we know that the second derivative of u is also 0, just by virtue of the heat equation. We automatically know that uxx of 0 and t is equal to 0. And by the derivative of the heat equation, we also know that uxxxx of 0 and t is 0. So why is this Fourier series converging so fast? Because all of the even derivatives of u, by virtue of the heat equation, are 0. So we've solved the wrong problem. Why? We have solved the problem. This solution here, this is not wrong, but unfortunately, this is the solution to the problem with g identically 0 and h identically 0. What did we do wrong? Yeah?
The problem that when we wrote that general solution is that form with sine of nx, mm-hmm. like that sine of nx was like, we tailored it so that it would satisfy the boundary conditions to be always 0 at x equals 0 and x equals 5.
No, no, no. Remember, a Fourier series can represent a function that is not 0. We're saying that this thing represents a function that is not 0. It isn't, because we want it to be g over here and h over here. But we did something wrong, because we got the wrong answer, obviously. What did we do that was wrong? Nobody sees it?
Is it that you assume that that only the coefficient depends on time?
No, no, no. This is what a Fourier series is. For each value of time, for each value of t, we have a function that is smooth and continuous. It isn't zero at the boundaries, but therefore it has a Fourier series expansion, just like the function 1. Okay? That's a Fourier series. But we did something terribly wrong. And come on, somebody must be able to...
You turned the series into the differential equation, and the only conversion of the open interval, not on the boundary.
Exactly. What did we do? We said, we're solving this differential equation. So what I did was to differentiate the Fourier series. Terrible! You can't differentiate a Fourier series term by term. You can, of course, you can differentiate the function u, because it satisfies the differential equation. But you can't differentiate the Fourier series. Why not? Because since this is not zero and this is not zero, how do the Fourier coefficients behave for large n? For large n, we know that these Fourier coefficients behave like 1 over n. I showed this to you last Friday. If we differentiate, we pull out a factor of n squared. So now the nth coefficient in this new Fourier series here, is of order n. This is a wildly divergent series. You can't differentiate a Fourier series. Fourier series are very delicate. And they cannot be differentiated. Of course, we did it anyway. And therefore, we ended up with a Fourier series over here. And this Fourier series can be differentiated as many times as you like, because the coefficients for large n behave like e to the minus n squared. So even if you differentiate this, you know, n squared times e to the minus n squared still goes to 0. Okay, so this Fourier series could be differentiated. But our Fourier series was not differentiable. And this is why they don't teach this. If you can't differentiate it, what use is a Fourier series for solving differential equations? Right? Well, this is a perfect time to stop. Okay, so next time, in the first 10 minutes of the lecture, I'm going to show you how to solve the problem correctly, and I'm going to show you how to incorporate these non-trivial boundary conditions in the Fourier series, okay, without differentiating the Fourier series. So I'm going to solve the differential equation without differentiating, evidently, because I can't differentiate the Fourier series. Okay? That's the idea. Yeah?
To solve a differential equation, you usually integrate, right?
To solve a differential equation, usually you integrate. And that's right. Okay? But of course, what we did was we said, let's assume a solution of the following form and plug it in. Well, you can't do that. You can't assume a solution of this form because you can't differentiate it. Imagine finding a solution to a differential equation that you can't differentiate. Do you understand what I'm saying? When I was a little kid, my teacher explained to me, I was taking a course in differential equations, okay? They explained to me, this is a wonderful course because you don't ever make careless mistakes. Why not? Because when you solve the differential equation, you don't leave it there. You plug it back in and see if it makes the differential equation true. Right? If you solve a differential equation, you check your work by differentiating it. But we can't check our work, apparently, because we can't differentiate the answer. But we're going to find the answer anyway. Okay? And now you're going to see the power of Fourier series. All right.